This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As he lays out a new vaccination goal for July 4th, U.S. President Joe Biden is appealing to Americans who have not yet received COVID-19 shots or who don't want them. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president says amid all the misinformation about the vaccines, there's one fact everyone should know.
People who are not fully vaccinated can still die every day from COVID-19.
He acknowledges convincing people he calls doubters will be hard, but says the choice is between life and death.
Why take the risk?
Right now, about 56% of adults have received at least one shot. Nearly 105 million are fully vaccinated. The president's aiming to make those numbers 70% and 160 million by July 4th. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A top Indian expert, Rajesh Bhushan, is warning that the coming weeks in India will be horrible as COVID-19 infections and deaths mount with alarming speed, and there is no end in sight for the crisis. A country of nearly 1.4 billion people has witnessed scenes of people dying outside overwhelmed hospitals and funeral pyres lighting up the night sky. India's official count of coronavirus cases surpassed 20 million, nearly doubling in the past 3 months. While deaths officially exceed 220,000, but the true figures are believed to be far higher, the undercount of an apparent symptom of the troubles in the healthcare system. This is VOA News. Drone footage showed cranes working to remove a second train carriage from the site of an overpass collapse on Tuesday that killed at least 24 people and injured dozens when a train on Mexico City's newest metro line plunged into a busy road below. The crash has raised wider questions about safety on one of the world's busiest metro systems, which carries millions of people daily across an urban sprawl home to over 20 million people. Firefighters using heavy chains to stabilize the site pulled bodies and survivors from the wreckage before lowering one dangling carriage onto a truck in the afternoon. Some 79 people were injured, including 3 children. According to authorities, 21 people died on board the train and 3 died later after being taken to hospitals. Derek Chauvin's lawyers are seeking a new trial and an impeachment of the verdicts, AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
The attorney for former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has requested a new trial, saying the judge abused the discretion of the court and the verdict should be impeached due to jury misconduct. Chauvin was convicted last month of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the May 25th death of George Floyd. Attorney Eric Nelson says Judge Peter Cahill violated Chauvin's right to a fair trial when he denied Nelson's request for a change of venue due to pretrial publicity. Nelson also cites Cahill's refusal to sequester the jury for the trial or instruct jurors to avoid all media. Nelson's brief does not refer to reports that one of the jurors participated in an August 28th march in Washington, D.C. to honor Martin Luther King Jr. Floyd's brother and sister addressed the crowd at that march. I'm Mike Gracia.
A new U.S. intelligence assessment says any gains in women's rights in Afghanistan made in the last 2 decades will be at risk after the U.S. withdraws later this year. The unclassified report released Tuesday by the Director of National Intelligence says the Taliban remain broadly consistent in its restrictive approach to women and their rights and would roll back much of the past 2 decades' progress if the group remains in national power. It's the latest U.S. warning of the consequences of the Afghan withdrawal now underway 2 decades after American-led coalition toppled the Taliban. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu Hassan continues a visit to Kenya today, Wednesday.
The closer ties between the two countries will actually elevate the economic development for both countries as well, and therefore remove the competition that has been dodging the two countries in the past.
Eritrean president is on a two-day visit to Sudan. Rights groups urge Kenyan authorities not to shut down two refugee camps, and the European Union will not send observers to Ethiopia's June 5th parliamentary election.
Despite all efforts by the European Union, it was not possible to reach an agreement with the Ethiopian authorities for the deployment of an EU electoral observation mission. As conditions are not fulfilled, the deployment of the mission has been cancelled.
And Senegal hopes to export its waste management technology. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Samia Suluhu Hassan continues her visit to Kenya today, Wednesday, her first visit there since the death of her predecessor, John Magufuli. She is expected to address the Kenyan parliament today. On Tuesday, Kenya and Tanzania signed a gas pipeline deal that will run between the coastal cities of Mombasa and Dar es Salaam. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu arrived Tuesday in Kenya and was welcomed with a 21-gun salute at the State House. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi after the end of a closed-door meeting that lasted for more than 3 hours, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta said the two countries are ready to improve their relations. He said, "We have agreed to re-energize cooperation between our two countries." He said our ministers will be meeting from time to time so that they can work on improving our relations and solving challenges our people go through in doing business. Relations between the East African nation grew strained during the 5 years John Magufuli was president of Tanzania. Magufuli died of heart disease in March and was replaced by Suluhu, his vice president. Kenyatta said Tuesday he and Suluhu signed a gas pipeline deal that will improve the lives of his people and businesses. He said we have agreed to construct a gas pipeline from Dar es Salaam to Mombasa that will help reduce the cost of electric power. And it will also help our industry get environment-friendly energy in our country. Suluhu said she and Kenyatta agreed to reduce other barriers to bilateral trade.
Lakini kwa lengo la kukuza biashara pia na uwekezaji kati yetu tumekubaliana.
She said for us to grow businesses and investment between our two countries, we agreed to work on some of the challenges, especially non-tariff barriers that are witnessed in our borders. We agreed to phase those out. We want Kenya and Tanzania to sit and bring solutions to conditions that are set once in a while so that we do not have conditions. Kigen Murubasu teaches international relations and security at Strathmore University in Kenya. He says good relations between the two countries have the potential to spur economic growth.
When we look at the two countries, for them, what we're looking at probably prospects in terms of bilateral trade. So we're supposed to see probably bilateral trade going up. And of course, the free movement of people, which has been an issue, especially in the region. And if we look at the trade between Tanzania and Kenya, and we know both of them are port countries, I think the closer ties between the two countries will actually elevate the economic development for both countries as well, and therefore remove the competition that has been dodging the two countries in the past.
The two countries have also agreed that health officials should work together on COVID-19 issues. That was not the case under Tanzania's late president. Under Magufuli, Tanzanian officials denied COVID-19 was present in the country and cast doubt on the effectiveness of vaccines. Suluhu said Tuesday she and Kenyatta want to see health officials cooperating to ease the movement of people and goods. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Human rights groups in Kenya are urging authorities to reconsider plans to shut down two refugee camps next year that are home to over 400,000 refugees and asylum seekers. mainly from Somalia and South Sudan. Many have been living in the camps for years and are hoping that further negotiations can keep the camps open. Victoria Amuga reports from Nairobi.
The Kenyan government's recent announcement that it will close the Kakuma and Dadaab camps has the 400,000 residents of the camps in a state of anxiety. Among them is Ribe Andrew, who fled the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2012 due to conflicts in which some of his relatives were killed. He says the militia groups were fighting with the police in my country, so the police would come to the villages and beat up all of us and kill the youth. Ribe has since found a home in Kakuma, where he is raising his five children. His hope is that the Kenyan government will keep the camp open for him and his new family. He says, we were thankful when the government met with UNHCR and talked. He says, we hope that in this 1 year that is remaining, they can have further talks and not send us back to our country. Kenyan authorities argue that the two camps pose a security threat and are a strain to the country's resources. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees and the government have held ongoing talks about keeping the camps open. But in a statement released April 29th, Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i said Kenya is serious about completing a repatriation program which began in 2016. We therefore reiterate our earlier position to close both Dadaab and Kakuma camps by June 30th, 2022, Matiang'i said. Security experts say incidents of crime and violence related to the camps are too low to warrant their closure. George Musamali is a security analyst in Kenya.
Let's police the refugee camps more. Let's provide more resources to the refugee camps. And you'll find that even some of these refugees, some were even born there. You're sending them to countries that they've never been to. They don't even know.
Irungu Horton is executive director at Amnesty International Kenya. He agrees with the view that many camp residents are ill-suited to build new lives in Somalia or South Sudan.
For many of the refugees in Kenya, they are third-generation refugees. And therefore, for some of them, they will opt. They may opt to stay in Kenya in an integrated, to be integrated into Kenyan society. And I think that option should be explored and supported for those refugees that would prefer to stay in a country that they've known.
Kenya has threatened to close the camps in the past without following through. But as things stand now, refugees like Ribe have just over a year to leave the camps and start their new lives somewhere else. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
A spokesperson for the European Union has been given explanation why the EU decided to cancel sending observers to the June 5th Ethiopian parliamentary elections. Spokesperson Nabila Masrali says Ethiopia refused to meet basic requirements for the deployment of any electoral observation mission, including the independence of the mission and the importation of its own communication systems.
The EU and its member states have always supported the democratic transition in Ethiopia through assistance and with various electoral missions in the past. This year, the security and the political situation in the country do not favor positive conditions for the deployment of an electoral observation mission. After the visit of the EU preparatory mission in March to Ethiopia and extensive exchanges with the Ethiopian authorities at technical level over a possible UN and necessary step for its deployment, the EU has been engaged in negotiations with the Ethiopian MFA on the administrative agreement to agree on the preconditions to the deployment. And despite all efforts by the European Union, it was not possible to reach an agreement with the Ethiopian authorities on key parameters for the deployment of an EU electoral observation mission. As conditions are not fulfilled, the deployment of the mission has been cancelled. So obviously, it is disappointing that the EU has not received the assurances necessary to expand to the Ethiopian people one of its most visible signs of support for their quest for democracy. The EU encourages, obviously, the Ethiopian authorities to increase efforts to guarantee that all Ethiopians can exercise their legitimate political and civil rights. And I would like to remind you that the EU has been supporting the National Electoral Board of Ethiopia in the preparation of these elections with more than 20 million euros as part of our efforts to help to ensure credible, inclusive and transparent elections.
So, Nabila, tell me, what are the requirements that the EU asks of Ethiopia that you think Ethiopia has not met? Again, I read somewhere where the Ethiopian foreign ministry spokesperson said perhaps one of the points of this agreement has been about communication systems. What are the requirements?
Well, as I said earlier, the conditions to conduct the election observation mission are not fulfilled, and therefore the deployment has been cancelled. You have to know that the integrity of an electoral observation mission is a cornerstone of the EU's support for democracy and must be upheld at all times. So that's why we have very clear standards and requirements. A standard requirement for the deployment of an electoral observation mission includes being able to guarantee the independence of the mission, meaning public and free communication on the mission's findings. Unfortunately, the Ethiopian authorities rejected any public statement by the EOM before the elections, and thus independence of the mission could not be upheld. Another element is the security, as you were just mentioning, of the EOM staff, which must be guaranteed at all times, in particular in the context of a challenging security environment. So to this end, all EOM use mission communication systems, such as satellite phones. Without such an equipment, the observers cannot be deployed, as their security cannot be guaranteed. So the Ethiopian authorities did not allow the import of the satellite communication equipment to guarantee the safety of communication.
Is it fair to say, Nabila, that the EU believes that conditions in Ethiopia are not ripe for a free and fair election to take place? Is that one of the reasons?
I think our statement has been extremely clear. The conditions to conduct an election observation mission are not fulfilled, and therefore we will not be able to deploy the mission.
Nabila, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Nabila Masrali is the spokesperson for the European Union. She was speaking with us from Brussels, Belgium. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 5th. Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki continues his two-day visit to Sudan today, Wednesday. Sudanese authorities say Afwerki and General Abdel Fattah Bourang of Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council have been having talks on bilateral cooperation. But the visit comes as Sudan and Ethiopia have been having border disputes, and Eritrea has been criticized for its support of Ethiopia in the Tigray conflict. Sudanese-born Bakri El-Mandni is Associate Professor of Business at Long Island University in New York.
And I imagine that it's a geopolitical and regional issues that has everything to do with what's going on at the borders. And, of course, the disagreement over the dam are all in play. And SAS has always been a guy who knows how to position himself in the political situation in the region, something bigger than his size as a country or as anything.
Exactly. So what do you think could be at the center of his visit? What would be the purpose of his visit to Sudan?
I think maybe a couple of things could be gleaned from that visit. One, SAS did not really want to end up being in a situation that he had to choose between Ethiopia and Sudan for a lot of reasons. Sudan is an unstable country, but Sudan could also become a huge factor in destabilizing Eritrea itself. At the same time, SAS is in a position that he actually managed to resolve the conflict with Ethiopia in a way that is not going to be that easy for Ethiopians. So I assume SAS is trying to play this really quiet game of like threading the needles between maintaining the relationship with Ethiopia, which actually led to peacemaking.
As you are saying, as he goes to Sudan, there's the dispute in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, and Eritrea had been accused of being involved there. And also Sudan and Ethiopia, there's been some land dispute between them. So is the Eritrean president going to play some kind of a mediation between the two countries?
I doubt it. I think the issues between Sudan and Ethiopia are multi-layered and very complex at this point. And Eritrea, as a country, it doesn't have any strategic power or leverage
Eritrea is a small country. Yes, it has been stable relatively in the past few years, but it doesn't have much of anything to offer. And that's exactly what I think Etias is trying to do. He's trying to position himself as a good friend with Abiy and a strategic partner, but also as somebody who closes to his culture, and most of the Eritrean leadership spend most of their youth time in Sudan, and they're very well versed in Sudanese culture. So I can imagine he would like to play that role. Question is he qualified? Could he actually be any force for good? I doubt it.
And I wanted to see whether you can comment on this story also that developed about an ally of the former president Bashir saying now that he's willing to go to the ICC for the war crimes allegations against him and former president. What do you make of this change?
I think it's a political maneuver rather than genuine desire. Maybe at some point, it's Ahmad Haroon, that's his name, by the way. He used to be a minister of cultural affairs, but also at some point he was the governor of Southern Kordofan region. And he's known to be one of the jihadists and the really bloodiest leaders of Bashir's era. So I think he's trying to play a game by saying he's actually making the point to criticize how failed and how weak and fragile the transitional government. He's only making the point to say this government is so weak and I don't trust them to administer justice. And therefore, I would like to go to Hague. He could probably mean it. Given what's going on in Sudan is, yes, the state is weak. There are lots of unknown things. And at some point, things could get out of control and he could find himself being assassinated without any due cause, you know? So in a way, you could say he wanted to score some political points by criticizing the government and show how weak the government is. And also, he wouldn't mind if he would, you know, go to ICC, because at least in ICC doctrine, he would not be... there is no what's called capital punishment. And that's something exists in Sudanese law. So as long as he convicted, whether it is, we can criticize the administration of justice in Sudan all day long, but if somehow he's found guilty, he could be sentenced to death. In ICC, he would never be sentenced to death. The worst case scenario, he might spend, 10, 15 years in prison if found guilty.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Take care, James. Good luck.
Sudanese-born Bakri El-Mani is Associate Professor of Business at Long Island University in New York. He was speaking with us from New York City. Hundreds of bronzes from the former Benin Empire were looted in the late 19th century, and many ended up in the museums of Western countries. After many years of advocacy, Germany, Britain, and some European museums are pledging to return some of the bronzes, while many others are refusing to do so.
In recent weeks, a university in Scotland and museums in Germany and Britain pledged to repatriate the Benin bronzes they own. The restitution is hugely symbolic to Timothy Awoyemi, a British-born Nigerian who helped repatriate two Benin bronzes in 2014 from a private collector whose grandfather had been part of the 19th century looting. Awoyemi says he was elated when he heard about the latest returns.
They stole it, so it makes me happy because the stolen artifacts are going to be returned back to where they rightly belong.
British soldiers looted the Kingdom of Benin in what is currently Edo State in Nigeria during a punitive military expedition in 1897. The high-valued plaques, masks, and sculptures functioned as an historical archive to the Benin Royal Palace. The sculptures made of brass, bronze, and ivory are now owned and displayed across Western museums and institutions. Oxford professor Dan Hicks is the curator of the Pitt's River Museum, which holds 145 Benin objects. He authored a book about the bronzes and says the displays of stolen art in Western museums continues to hurt people in the present.
The dispossession of art and culture was a central sort of part of how military operations that sought to remove sovereignty and sought to destroy traditional religion and sought to remove identity, you know, culture. That was a central part of what the Europeans were doing in the 1880s, 1890s. you know, across Africa.
Hicks says the argument that Western museums would be emptied out or shut down is unlikely, as restitution needs a case-by-case approach. Thousands of bronzes from the former Benin Empire are held in private collections and in over 160 museums around the world. Most have offered to discuss loaning the bronzes instead of repatriation. The British Museum in London holds about 900 Benin objects, the largest collection in the world. Its website reads, no formal written request has been received for the return of the entire Benin collection, despite the bronzes being filed under contested objects. Additionally, laws would need to be changed because British national collections are prohibited from giving away their collection. The African Foundation for Development, AFORD, is a British-based charity which for the past year has investigated the challenges and obstacles related to returning African artifacts. Executive Director Onyekachu Wambu says that even if the national collections aren't willing or able to repatriate, there are many more places and people owning Benin bronzes.
There are lots of different museums around the country which have their own collections and they're not covered by the law. There are others that are in private collections, and those are going to be much more difficult to do, and because, you know, those people sometimes don't want to do it.
It's said over 90% of African cultural legacy is held outside the continent. Although many Western countries have laws ensuring the return of Nazi-looted art, this approach has not been extended when it comes to art stolen from Africa and other parts of the world. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
Marking a decade of existence this year, Senegal's solid waste management system, known by its French acronym UCG, has transformed the landscape of the West African country's streets. Originally started as a temporary federal government system to improve trash collection in cities such as Dakar, the public entity employs more than 4,000 people that keep the cities clean. UCG National Coordinator Mas Tiam tells Ricky Stryak that they hope to eventually create a circular economy from the West and export to neighboring West African countries.
Normally, it was supposed to be a provisory company, let's say it that way. But because of those challenges, UCG is still on the ground and running and in charge of all the waste collection activities. And actual challenges of UCG is to turn the waste management system in Senegal into a circular economy, because as of today we still have just this waste collection activities, and there is no recycling, or there's a bit of valorization and in terms of compost and also some plastic issues, but generally speaking there is no real industry around waste in Senegal. So one of our major challenges as of today is to set up a real industry around waste in Senegal, put a step beyond waste collection.
What is the role of UCG in public health and environmental conservation?
We have a big role in terms of prevention and over public health, because what we used to see in Africa is that people used to put the waste from the households down the street. And generally speaking, it leads to a lot of type of contamination, because it gets into the soils, and also some animals are around, and children and so on. So that's why in our strategy, we also try to promote the conditioning of waste. Coming back to environmental issues also, we have a big role, because if I take the example of plastic, in Senegal, we have managed to get a law which prevents companies such as industrial ones to import plastic in Senegal. But it doesn't, it has been on the ground just 1 year ago. So as of today, we still have a big issue around plastic. So UCG is also committed to take some actions and prevent the plastic that we used to see all around the cities.
Could UCG serve as a model for other cities in West Africa?
We have a bunch of success stories that we'll be very pleased to try to introduce in some neighboring countries. So we have set up a commercial division inside UCG, which is actually developing offers. Our aim is to try to have a specific offer that we can promote for the neighboring countries of Senegal, such as Mali Guinea or whatever, because we think that we have really some experience to be sold to those countries. So we're looking after that, really.
That was Mass Etiam, National Coordinator of Senegal's Waste Management System. You are speaking to Ricky Stryer from the capital, Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, May 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Button, Washington, saying, have a great day.